Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 10, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews scheduled tonight. First, with the young artist Sunny Taylor, talking about her work, but she's also disabled, paints with her mostly with her mouth. And there was a story about her at NPR the other day, and they wouldn't let her explain why she's disabled. It was poisons from a U.S. Air Force base that she was exposed to in utero that was not deemed acceptable material for an NPR interview. So we'll get Sunny to correct the record here, with perhaps not quite as big an audience as you get in All Things Considered, but without the censorship that goes along with that NPR brand. And then at the bottom of the hour, or slightly after, we'll speak with the feminist development specialist Nyla Kabir about things like labor standards and trade agreements, which she doesn't like, and also impact of development on poverty, whether there is indeed a race to the bottom, and all kinds of issues like that. That's towards about a little after 5:30. And at the midsection, just after the 5:30 break, play a little music that was partly inspired by an interview that appeared on this show. The words of the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, interviewed here on April 2003, were cut into some electronic music by a composer who lives in Sarajevo. We'll play a bit of that and tell you where you can download that if you're so moved. On the way down here, I noticed that they've slapped Olympics decals all over the subway cars now. And that's not enough that we have to look at all the pro-Olympics propaganda walking around town on every billboard and payphone. But now we've got to look at it on the subway cars, too. It's extremely annoying. I'm really just tired of the whole move of turning the city into a theme park. I'm annoyed by the Bloomberg administration's proposed slogan that they're trying to copyright: New York City, the world's second home. Well, for about 7 million or more of us, it's our first home. Don't we count? I don't think so. It's all about the rich tourists and the business people and the TV shows and movies that are made here. But those of us who live here, well, you know, we're just part of the background noise, I guess. And a couple of announcements before we get to the week's economic headlines. Our friends at the Brecht Forum, they are about to resume their programming after they moved from their old site in West 27th Street to a new site in the far West Village. I'm sure you've been hearing announcements for this in other shows, but I will underscore this. They're now at 451 West Street in the West Beth Complex. The entrance is on Bank Street, Bank and West Street. 451 West Street, the address, enter on Bank. And next couple of weeks, this coming Monday, March 14, from 6 to 8 p.m., a photo exhibition, and then 8 p.m., a film screening and discussion, Speak Out, I Had an Abortion, including the filmmakers Julian Aldrich and Jennifer Baumgardner, joined by Katha Pollitt, Tara Todres-Whitehill, moderated by Liza Featherstone. This is a documentary in which talks to people, to women who had abortions, and they'll be talking about that, trying to remove some of the indefensible and undeserved stigma from having an abortion. That's this coming Monday, 8 p.m. at the Brecht Forum. Then next, a week from today, unfortunately during this show, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., Thursday, March 17, Dilemmas of Domination, The Unmaking of the American Empire, a book party and discussion by, with Walden Bellow. Has been a frequent guest on this show. He will be talking about his latest book about the unmaking of the American Empire, which may be a little bit more optimistic than I'd like to be, but anyway, that's next Thursday at 5:30. And then after that, same night, same place, Thursday, March 17th at 8 p.m., a book, DVD, party, and forum, Chavez, Venezuela, and the New Latin America. And then the following Friday, a week from tomorrow, 7:30 p.m., book, party, forum, with Mahmoud Mamdani, who I'd like to get on this show sometime soon, author of the new book, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror. That's all at the Brecht Forum, which is 451 West Street, new location, Far West Village, enter on Bank Street. And let's see, the economic news. We've got the usual report of last week's jobless claims, that is the A number of people who lost their jobs last week and walked over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. Very, very timely and sensitive indicator of what's happening in the job market. That rose unexpectedly last week by 17,000, the four-week moving average, which smooths out some of the volatility in the week-to-week numbers, also rose. The tally of people who continuing to draw benefits, that is not first-time claimants, but people who continue to draw unemployment benefits, that also rose by 39,000. The improvement that we've seen in the job market, especially in this claims indicator in the last several weeks, at least partly reversed last week. We'll see if this means anything, but it suggests to me that a little bit of the optimism about a recovering job market was probably somewhat overblown. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, a very good measure of what's going to, or predictor of what's going to happen with the U.S. economy 3, 6, 9 months out in the future, continues in its uptrend. It had had a pretty rough 2004, falling in much of the second half of the year. But it's been recovering since the beginning of this year, which suggests that the slowdown in the U.S. economy late last year may be running its course, and we may see an acceleration in the coming months. However, if oil prices stay high and the Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, then we may not see that kind of acceleration. But at least for now, that weekly leading indicator pointing upwards. Some signs that the red-hot housing market in the United States is slowing down, as the Mortgage Bankers Association's weekly tally of applications for new mortgages fell last week, continuing its fourth straight week of decline. That was led by the component of the index that measures people applying for mortgage refinancings, which lately have been just people taking out new mortgages in their house and taking some cash out of the on the appreciated value and spending the proceeds. It was one of the things that kept the U.S. economy going the last several years, but some signs that that trend is slowing down. And then last Friday morning brought the monthly U.S. employment report, pretty solid one. On first glance, showed a gain of 262,000 jobs. Manufacturing sector, which had been battered for years, added 20,000 workers. Construction added 30,000. Government up 10,000. Private services up 174,000. Pretty healthy numbers. But at a closer look, the numbers were less inspiring. The gains in manufacturing largely result of return of auto workers after a longer than usual retooling. Construction gains were concentrated in the specialty trade, the people who finish buildings rather than the ones who start them. There are also revisions, downward revisions to the tally of months, earlier months' job gains. So, all in all, a decent but not spectacular employment report. Hourly earnings, seriously weak, unchanged, that is, on average, which means that it's not keeping up with inflation, and was actual last month's decline, or last month's performance in hourly earnings was the 13th worst performance in a serious 493-month history. So we have some slack in the job market and some slack in earnings. Continue to see people dropping out of the labor force. We should not be seeing that at this point in the economic cycle. We should see people entering the labor force, but they seem to think that prospects are not so bright. And then finally, the Federal Reserve released its so-called beige book, which is a roundup of what's going on in the economy, which is prepared for the meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, the part of the Fed that sets monetary policy, and they meet every 6 weeks or so. And that so-called beige book reports that the economy continued to expand at a moderate pace since the last report. All 12 of the Federal Reserve districts report increasing activity, although some districts did better than others. A number of employers are complaining about pressure from higher benefit costs, that is, higher insurance, health insurance costs particularly, and also complained about the difficulty in locating skilled workers. They'll do anything but pay people if they can help it. Manufacturing showed some solid gains in the month, but not accelerating. Sustained increases in the cost of energy, steel, and other basic materials were pretty widespread. So this is still a little early to be offering this as a theory of what's going on, but it's quite possible that we were spoiled by the long expansions of the 1980s and 1990s. They saw in the middle of them declines in oil prices, which led commodity prices down, and the usual thing that we saw in business cycles in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which saw rising prices, rising inflation, and the Federal Reserve clamping down. That didn't happen in the 80s and 90s. Those drops in oil prices brought prices down with them and kept the Fed from tightening too much. We are not seeing that this time. So we may be going back to those older, shorter business cycles with 3 years or so between recessions rather than the 8 or 9 we saw in the last 2 decades. So a little early to say whether this is a new trend or not, but it's something that bears watching in the coming months. Let's take a little musical break and come back with Sonny Taylor. And that was a little excerpt from the Piano Sonata No. 2 by Johannes Brahms, performed by Sviatoslav Richter. The Brahms Piano Sonata No. 1 last week was such a hit, I thought I'd bring back its sibling, No. 2, for entertainment this week. And we'll hear a bit more of that at the end of the show. And now we're joined in the line by Sonny Taylor, who is an artist who lives in Georgia and who was profiled at All Things Considered earlier in the week, but not allowed to tell her full story. So let's bring on Sonny to tell her full story. Welcome to WBAI, Sonny Taylor.
How are you?
Thanks for joining us. And you... Sonny Taylor is an artist of great talent, and since this is radio, you have to take my word for that. You can't actually see the paintings, but you can look at her website, Sonny Taylor, S-U-N-N-Y, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R.org, and get a taste for yourself. But even on the web, they don't come across in their full splendor because many of them are quite large and very impressive in that regard, but you're not going to be able to see that on the computer screen. But in any case... the NPR folks profiled Sonny, but wouldn't let her tell the full story. So tell us about your experience with NPR, Sonny.
Well, most of it actually was really quite lovely, and I really liked the interviewer and everything. And then, but I was just very disappointed when it actually aired because they switched around the very important aspect of my story, which is the cause of my disability. I have arthrogryposis, and it was caused by military pollution. And basically they just cut that out and just said it was caused by industrial pollution, which is very broad and which basically, avoids a whole very important topic of the military being involved with that. So,
what was the details of the pollution? Where did it come from, and how did it affect you?
It came from I was born in Tucson, Arizona, and basically there's a huge population on the south side of Tucson that was affected by pollution caused by largely Hughes Air Force Base was there, and a bunch of other industrial companies and stuff like that, but Hughes was one of the main ones, and they had just been polluting all sorts of different nasty chemicals that were used in making and cleaning missiles and airplanes, and they had just been dumping them in the ground and burying them because, you know, I guess they didn't know what to do with them or something, and they eventually seeped into the groundwater. And I've just been researching it because I'm studying this for school right now. And so the other day I was researching it and found out that they knew about it in the 50s and they did nothing. And then in the 80s, eventually it was brought to the public's attention and a lawsuit happened and stuff. So.
And you won a judgment against the military?
Not against the military. We basically, because it's virtually impossible to sue the military or the Air Force there, and so we basically had to go about a roundabout way suing the city of Tucson, suing insurance companies, and a few other places like that. And actually, the whole case isn't finished yet, but you know, the Department of Defense has all sorts of ways of getting around stuff like that because they're such a huge polluter. The U.S. military, so it's really hard to sue them directly.
Yeah, and of course, the government has something called sovereign immunity, right, where you they don't have to be sued unless they agree to it.
And yeah.
Since they're not insane, they're not going to agree to it.
Yeah.
Well, how did you get into painting? I mean, it's not an obvious match since you can't very easily pick up a paintbrush. So.
I think my mom was a painter, and so... and my siblings and I were actually homeschooled, and so, you know, there was just a lot of free time, and then she was there painting a lot, and it just seemed very, just seemed really fun to me as a kid. And I had always really loved drawing and stuff like that, and so I think it just made sense to me, and, you know, I figured out that I could paint with the brush in my mouth and stuff, and so, I just fell in love with it.
And you've said you initially didn't want to draw attention to the disability because people would focus on that and not on the art. You changed your mind along the way. What happened?
Yeah, well, and that's actually what really drove me crazy about the NPR thing is that they actually quoted me as saying that, you know, like, because for me, they're two very different topics because I feel like I would be a painter even if I wasn't disabled, you know. And they quoted me as saying somehow that I just think it's very important for people to know about disability as a political rights issue, but then also about how I became disabled. And so that kind of led me to decide basically that it was okay to talk about it while also talking about my art. But then, of course, on NPR, they quoted me as saying that and then actually took out what actually happened to me and just made it more politically safe, I guess, or something. So.
And you've written a couple of pieces, one monthly review about the right not to work, which is starts off with a rather in-your-face kind of opening here. I have a confession to make. I do not work. I am an SSI. I have very little work value. I am a drain on our country's welfare system. I do not think this is wrong, and to be honest, I am very happy not working. So that's certainly a provocative opening.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about why you're happy not working.
Well, I think there were two parts of that article. One part was basically a really broad overview of disability theory and basically why disability should be seen as a civil rights issue and kind of drawing attention to a lot of those issues that are ignored. And then the other part of it was kind of taking from that basically discussing disability in terms of capitalism and how because of people's value being largely in this system, being in their production value, how basically disabled people can't fit into that. Because very few of us have very good production value. And then it was basically just a broad critique of if that's something that we should all long for as being good workers, disabled people and able-bodied people alike.
Well, yeah, you write about a conflict between desire to sort of fit in with the existing system versus changing it.
Yeah.
What are the poles of that struggle?
Well, I think for disabled people, I mean, I think it's it's probably something that fits in with a lot of struggles. I'm actually taking a globalization class right now, and he's just talking about the environmental movement and how, you know, there's sometimes to get things done, you can't be quite as idealistic as you'd like to be, maybe. But in terms of disability, I think I'm of the opinion that it's going to be very hard for disabled people to really make themselves equal in a society that won't value their inherent value, that that doesn't necessarily depend on them being good workers and being good for the economy and being whatever idea of self-sufficient and self or independent is, you know. And so I guess it's kind of a broad question of like of just what do we expect from our government? Do we expect a government to help its citizens and to support its citizens and to help them live healthy and meaningful lives? Or do we want a system where people have to spend, you know, all their time working jobs that are often incredibly unhealthy and have, you know, very bad labor laws and stuff like that. So
yeah, you say that when you mention to people that you're a painter, the first question they often ask is, well, do you sell your paintings?
Yeah.
Is that the only measure of value that conventional types can imagine for painting?
I feel like a lot of the time it is, and that is a question that I get all the time, and then also suggestions on how I could sell my paintings and how I could best make most money selling my paintings, and I think that there's a lot of legitimacy, of course, to people offering that advice and asking that, because obviously we live in a world where money is incredibly needed, and people need to be able to feed their families and live comfortably and such. But I guess that's actually the main question is, why do we live in a system in which that is so incredibly difficult to, considering that our country is so wealthy and stuff, is that, you know, where that has to be in such a huge issue for people in terms of feeling guilty and stuff, also for not necessarily working. And
I'm speaking with Sonny Taylor, who is a young artist based in Athens, Georgia, and you can see her writing and some samples of her painting at the webs on the web at Sonny Taylor, SunnyTaylor.org. You write in the piece about the distinction between impairment and disability. Could you discuss that a bit?
Okay. Well, disability theorists have this distinction, which is basically that impairment is the actual embodiment of being disabled. For instance, my body, my arms, I can't really use my arms, and my muscles are weak. It's sort of the actual physicality of being disabled. Disability, on the other hand, is sort of more defined as the political and social and geographical discrimination that goes along with being impaired, that has developed, you know, over hundreds of years, basically, in our system, in terms of just the structures that exist and what our society finds meaningful. That makes any sense?
You also have a piece in your site about a march, Adapts for Our People March, you said it. There also, for a while, you didn't associate with disabled people, and then you went on this march, and a lot of things happened. What was that all about, and when did that happen? What was it all about?
I think it was 2002, and it was actually a march for a piece of legislation that people are trying to get passed right now that is for in-home care, because there are just thousands of disabled people right now who are stuck in nursing homes who really shouldn't be there, except it's just a huge industry. It's about a $70 billion industry. It's there are all these people, and many of them were actually on the march, who have escaped basically from nursing homes with the help of ADAPT, the organization that I marched with, who basically are fighting for their rights to have in-home care, which actually in the long run is cheaper but it doesn't go directly to this huge industry in nursing homes that's already developed, and so it's something that they're having a really hard time fighting. But that was an amazing march, because some of these people were just very, very severely disabled, and we camped out on highways, and we marched on highways and camped out in parking lots, and it was really remarkable 2 weeks.
And you hadn't been associated with the disabled movement before that?
Not really. I think I had always sort of, it had never been on my radar as something that that I wanted to participate in. And I think that a lot of that was just insecurities I hadn't dealt with. The personal stuff that I needed to deal with to be able to think about that. And I was very much just on that sort of path of thinking, okay, well, I don't have to be seen as disabled or something, which is basically, once I got to know ADAPT, I realized that actually that's just a symptom of being guilty about being disabled largely. And I think I also just had never been put into a situation where I could be around other disabled people, because it was never something that my parents really, not that they didn't support it, but just that it was never really a priority. You know, they really wanted me to be involved in whatever my other interests were, like painting or, you know, and just to not only have that be my identity. And so I think that kind of translated as me thinking that it shouldn't be my identity in some way, until I had to start confronting these issues, and then I found ADAPT.
All right. Well, your identity is also as a very talented painter, with a young and with a lot of promise ahead of you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Sunny Taylor.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
Sunny Taylor, artist based in Athens, Georgia. And, again, you can check out her stuff on the web at Sunny Taylor, SunnyTaylor.org. And I'll be back in a little bit. Let's take a little break and then listen to some music.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth. I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say that over and over, and there was no escape. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And that was my hero, Iggy Pop, again, doing the station ID. This is the program that's behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood, and I did an interview in April 2003 with a Slovenian philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, someone heard it on the web. Sarajevo-based musician named, I'm sorry if I'm mangling the pronunciation of this, Sefik S. Tatlik, who goes under the nom de musique of Jed Whittaker, which is a lot easier to pronounce for an American. And he took some samples from that interview and mixed it up with some electronic music, and produced an EP, Democracy Suspends Relevance. And the whole thing is about 14, 15 minutes long, but just put together some excerpts from it. Let's listen to those. It's about two and a half minutes. So let's listen to these excerpts from Democracy Suspends Relevance with the voice of the philosopher Slobodan Žižek from an interview broadcast here April 2003.
Where do we have this democracy now? We have democracy at a certain level of these false, for me, secondary choices. Yes, lifestyles, gay marriages, and so on and so on. But isn't it that already for decades, key questions about monetary politics, globalization, trade agreements, and so on. I mean, nobody votes about that. Different levels, we'll have to directly curtail, limit gradually democracy. Typical. What is typical? It's not simply emergency state, but it's at the same time, emergency state and normal state. Typical. Something like that with all world tensions will gradually emerge as a normal way of life. Typical. Emergency state, new order.
And that was an excerpt from the piece Democracy Suspends Relevance by the Sarajevo-based musician Sefik Tutlik, who goes under the name Jed Whitaker, which is a lot easier to pronounce for me. And you can download the full piece, which is about 15 minutes long, from on the web at www.oscillator.net, oscillator.net, and includes some sampled material from my interview with the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, which was first broadcast on the show April 2003. And now we're joined in the studio by Nala Kabir, who is a London-based feminist development specialist. Are you actually a sociologist or economist?
Well, I used to be an economist, but I think I'm a sociologist.
Okay. Your interests are too broad to be a real economist, right?
Yeah.
You had a book that came out from Bursa a few years ago. What was the name of that?
It was called The Power to Choose.
The Power to Choose.
Bangladeshi Women and Labour Market Decisions in London and Dhaka.
Yeah, and in that book you were comparing the attitudes of women in Bangladesh and in the UK. And as I recall, it's been a long time since I read it, but there's a kind of line in the global justice movement or the anti-globalization movement or whatever we call it these days,
mm-hmm.
That women would don't want to be drawn into industrial work and they want to go back and tend the fields and that sort of thing. Do you find any of that in your studies of the women workers?
I didn't realize that that was one of the lines of the anti-globalization people. No, I didn't. I assume we're talking about the ones in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
I think they would like to leave the fields. And you have to remember, in Bangladesh, they're not working out in the fields. They're not allowed to work out in the fields unless they're very, very poor. So most of them are working in small-scale income-generating activities at home, which don't yield a lot of money. So for many of them, going into the cities and having some sort of a life and working has allowed them to do things like postpone the age of marriage. In Bangladesh, people were getting married at 14 or 15. The age of marriage has now been postponed. The age at which people start having children has been postponed. So in a sense, as someone described it, young girls are getting an adolescence. Of course, it's an adolescence working quite hard in the factories. But for many of them, it represents an improvement on the choices they had previously.
What does it do with the relations with men?
On the basis of my study, I think what it does, it provides them with some kind of leverage to renegotiate relations within the household. So if they are married and if they have very abusive husbands, it's allowed them to walk out. If they're married and they have conflictual marriages, then it allows them to get a bit better deal within the marriage. If they're married and they're happily married, then they're contributing as much as the men, and that's also something quite positive.
And how do these attitudes differ from what you saw with the workers in London?
Well, the workers in London, and this was a study that was carried out really at the beginning of the 90s, so it might be a little different now. And that was when there was a garment industry in London, which is now much, much smaller. And what was very remarkable, of course, is that in London they are immigrants. They are a black minority. And the minority who have come from the countryside often don't have education, don't speak English. So they're, in a sense, I think at that time, were a very besieged minority, and they are still not doing very well within the economic structures, although the young girls are performing quite well in school. So in London, you've got a much more tense set of negotiations between men within the family and their women, to the extent that most women in London were not working in factories at all, but in home-based piecework, unlike women from other groups who are all working in the factories, in the sweatshops in London.
Do they regret the decision of having to come to England, or they rather stay at home in Bangladesh?
Some of the younger women regretted it. They had no say in the matter. Their families came. But others felt that at least their children had a chance of a decent education. And most of them came from a part of Bangladesh where there is, you know, very few schools and so on. So they felt perhaps that there was a future for their children, even if they themselves were not benefiting very directly.
Now, another part of, we frequently hear a talk of a race to the bottom, that globalization has led to an increase in poverty rather than a decrease in poverty. Mm-hmm. Does that match with what you've discovered?
You know, I think the global figures, there's a lot of sort of debate about the global figures, and as far as I can make out, the numbers of people in poverty have gone down, but inequalities have risen. Interestingly, of course, Bangladesh is a bit of an exception for some reason. And globalization has been quite good for it up to a point. We have seen a systematic drop in poverty at a modest but consistent rate of 1% a year over the last, since the early 1990s, which is also the time of transition to democracy. And we have seen, very striking improvements in human development indicators such as girls' education, such as infant mortality, maternal mortality. And we have also seen a striking increase in voting behavior. And women, I think, constituted about 85%. 85% of women who are eligible to vote were voting in the last election. So in a lot of ways, we've seen quite a rise in quite progressive. But I don't say that that's true for the rest of the world.
Well, yeah, what about, can you have anything to say about India?
India, the story is a little less, India has also seen a fall in poverty between mid-90s to the latest figures. But the official figures probably overestimate the fall in poverty. Falls in poverty over this period of over 5, 6, 7%. But in India, what India has seen is a much a really rapid rise in inequality. So we've seen rural incomes not really moving that much. But urban upper incomes really soaring very, very high. So India has also seen quite a lot of inequality.
And in China, we've seen rise in average incomes, increase in inequality. So there's some, we can almost generalize this story to a good bit of the world.
Yeah.
How can we think about this? At the same time, we see averages rising. At the same time, the dispersion, as economists like to say, between rich and poor is rising as well. Is this unbalance a good thing, a bad thing, a complicated thing?
I think most people, for myself, I think some increase in inequality is something that we can live with. It's when those inequalities become vast and the condition of the very poorest relative to what the very richest in a society can consume becomes obscenely large. I think then that's one of the times we should worry about inequality. I think also we should worry about inequality if it is seen to be achieved through unfair advantages. And I think a lot of the globalization story has been described to some extent as, you know, casino economics, that it's about speculative capital and so on. And people have got very rich on those kinds of strategies. So I think that leaves people feeling very uncomfortable. And I guess, you know, it still remains the case that, you know, the richest people in the richest countries of the world can spend on their pets or on their shoes, something that would pay for a health system in a third world country. So those two are somewhat obscene.
Yeah, I think Joe Stiglitz quotes this statistic that a cow in the EU gets more of a subsidy than the average income of an African, for example.
Yeah.
So there are these.
I mean, those
grotesques.
Are unacceptable kinds of dispersions.
But in general, does this race to the bottom exist, or is that a phrase that should be retired?
I think there is some kind of a, you know, leveling out of wages of lower skilled workers are probably facing a lot of pressure on their wages. Where that's coming from, I think, is, you know, a variety of different sources. And one of the things, actually looking at your book, which I looked at just before I came here, is it strikes me that America has been quite, the US has been quite an active player in the race to the bottom. Because if you look at the kind of security that it offers its workers, it does seem to be far lower than, you know, anywhere in Europe. And I know that in Britain, the trade unions are talking about trying to opt for the European model of social protection and social security for workers rather than the American model. So it strikes me as very interesting that one of the richest countries in the world gives so little security to its workers, thereby forcing them to be, you know, active players in the race to the bottom.
Yeah, it's much easier to blame other people for our problems than ourselves. I'm speaking with Naila Kabir, who is a development specialist at the University of Sussex, right?
Institute of Development Studies at Sussex,
And author of a Versa book, Power to Choose, which came out several years ago. I think a lot of people in the global justice movement, the anti-globalization movement, whatever, it's no longer called the anti-globalization movement, so let's shelve that one. But a lot of people would say that we need to trade less, and that economy should be much more reoriented towards home production and localized focus. Would that be a good thing in your view?
I don't think we should do it because somebody says so. I think we need to, I mean, for instance, opening up trade has been very good for many, many poor countries in the world, especially those that don't have very large domestic markets, you know, the smaller countries like Bangladesh. For us, you know, trade is essential if we are to grow and if we are to prosper. I guess what countries should be allowed to do is liberalize or, you know, open up their economies at a pace that feels right for them and protects their workers as best as they can. I think the problem has been that we have all been forced, and here again, I think the northern countries have been very active.
Particularly
the United States, in forcing us to open up our borders and to become, you know, liberalize our economies both internally and externally. So it's that part of it which I think has been a problem. And if Bangladesh has done reasonably well out of it, well, that's perhaps because it had a very distorted economy before.
I think most controversially, you've argued against the inclusion of labor standards in trade agreements. Yeah. Why is that?
There's a number of reasons. I think one is, I know it is the call of the trade union movement in this country and in other parts of the North, and I know it's supported by a lot of the students and activists. I think for me, and for many of us, I must say, in the South, the world is still too unequal, and to engage in a trade agreement where only one party has the capacity to penalize the other party for violation of labor standards seems very unfair. To engage into an agreement, to enter into an agreement where we look to the WTO, which is certainly not the least the most democratic of the international structures and where third world countries have very little say, to be arbitrators of disputes about labor standards also seems unfair. And I think it's the day when Bangladesh can take the U.S. or sanction the U.S. for violations of its own labor standards, its own workers' rights, that I think we can start entering into trade agreements. But right now it feels too much like a pressure from very powerful countries who have always been able to use the trading system to their own advantage.
Well, advocates of labor standards and trade agreements would say that the workers in the poorest countries are hideously exploited, and this would be a favor to them to include these labor standards in the WTO. And it would simultaneously protect workers in the first world and protect workers in the third. You don't see it that way.
No, I don't. I think the best thing you can do for workers in the third world is to enable them to keep their jobs and give them the support and the education that they need to fight for their rights. Simply taking a country to court because its government is seen it's not upholding labor standards is not going to do the workers of that country any favor. We have had attempts by northern countries to impose labor standards, such as through the idea of the Harkin Bill. And, of course, that led to very devastating consequences in Bangladesh in terms of the number of children that were immediately dismissed and went into far worse.
Could you amplify that a little bit?
Well, there was an attempt to pass a bill, which was put forward by, I think, Senator Tom Harkin, that would forbid the import of any goods from the third world which were supposed to have been made by child labor. Now,
which sounds like godly virtue in the face of it.
Well, yes, of course it does. But that's the problem. A lot of this, when it plays out in the kind of realities that of the third world, where you have vast numbers of people looking for jobs, many poor children relying on perhaps work, or at least my research tells me many of them are also in the factories to be kept out of trouble with their mothers. All that led to was lots of children losing their jobs. So my concern is that these kinds of agreements can be used in ways that are not very productive. That there is absolutely no guarantee, and past record does not give us any reason to trust people to use these kinds of agreements in ways that are constructive for the interests of third world workers. If we felt that these countries had a track record of working with the government, working with the unions, working with workers' organizations in strengthening the organizing capacity of workers, then we would have a track record on which to base trust. But I don't think there is a great deal of trust about the motivations of people who make these demands.
What could unions and activists in the first world countries do to promote that kind of agenda?
Well, actually, Solidarity is doing some interesting work in Bangladesh. And I suspect in other places, which is it's working with organizations of women workers to help them to build leadership skills amongst workers, to help them build legal literacy, to provide them access to lawyers to take employers to court, because we do have labor courts and they function, but they are not, you need resources to be able to take your employer to court. And that kind of work is much more arduous and more slow and painstaking, but it's what is needed, not this kind of maverick cowboy activity of people rushing in, exposing things and then asking for boycotts and that sort of thing, which is, I'm afraid, what I think might happen with this, the social clause idea.
You know, you shouldn't boycott anything unless the people at the other end are asking you to, right?
I think so. And the people at the other end are saying, we would like to see our labor standards improve, but we would not like to see our jobs jeopardized. And that, you know, you may not like the jobs, as everybody will tell you. You may not like the jobs, but they're better than what people have in the alternative.
And we've seen some efforts in this country to create garment manufacturers, for example, that like American Apparel, that say they use union labor either here or abroad, and swear they don't source their stuff from sweatshops. What do you think of that kind of approach?
Could you read the question?
Well, there's an organization, American Apparel, which has stores now all over the town, New York City, which says that their stuff is not made in sweatshops. It's made by organized workers, union workers abroad or here in the United States.
You know, I don't know that organization, but I do know that most of these organizations deal with the first tier of manufacturers, who may look very clean and, you know, observe all the labor standards, but a lot of these factories also subcontract. So what you have are, because I've been evaluating an initiative which claims to do something similar, and I can't mention it at the moment because the report's not out, but what we find is that, you know, there is a first level of employers who all appear to be complying with codes and, you know, labor standards. But they have many ways of subcontracting out or using, you know, irregular labor or various ways of bypassing some of those codes. I think, in principle, codes are useful because they are a way of increasing the debate about labor standards and, again, part of educating workers. But I'm not sure about the capacity of any organization to guarantee that. I might be being a little cynical, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's very hard to know what to do from this distance, and if your heart's in the right place, but you just don't know what exactly to do.
Well, I think one focus could be on looking at the U.S. policy to its own workers and fighting for higher levels of Social Security, because I think some of the pain that people feel when, you know, they seem to see a threat from competition is because they have so little to fall back on. It's interesting that this anti-sweatshop movement that you have on the campuses in the States, which I know has been, you know, pulled together with the help of unions, is not as active in Britain and in Europe. And I think it's partly because the threat of globalization doesn't seem to be quite as devastating for poor lower wage workers because there is some kind of social security. So I think one would be to focus on policy, domestic policies, and the other would be to promote, and this is a territory I'm getting into, I don't know that much about, but it's all the macroeconomic policies that the northern countries have adopted, and they seem to do very little to generate jobs. They seem to generate only the demand for sweated labor in the U.S. as well as elsewhere. So I would imagine that there could be some rethinking of economic policies towards a more managed Keynesian model, which might provide more employment for everyone.
And the slogan I'm trying to inject into the discourse is protect the worker, not the job.
But, I think that's brilliant.
And
I'm not having great
success with it. I'm going to keep trying.
Well, I'm going to support you.
And certainly we could certainly use a lot more protection of workers in this country instead of blaming our problems on people abroad. We should look and see what we can do at home first.
I think so.
And certainly not going to find it coming out of the Bush administration. Well, thank you for joining us, Nala Kabir. Nala Kabir, who teaches at the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Sussex in England and is visiting here, has a book from Verso, came out a couple of years ago, The Power to Choose. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with a little bit more of Brahms' second piano sonata performed by Sviatoslav Richter.